Welcome back. This is the Florida History Podcast, and continuing our journey through the state of Florida, talking about forts, we're going to talk today a little bit about Fort Jefferson, which is now in Dry Tortugas National Park. Hello, I'm Carter Krishnayer, your host, and this week I'm joined by Ryan Ray, who will be my co-host for this episode. Robert Bucciolato is out this week, and we're going to harken back to a conversation we had in July about Fort Jefferson, for those of you who may have missed that podcast, and we're replaying it today because it fits into the thematic journey we're going throughout the state right now, looking at different forts or talking about different forts. And of course, we did Fort Taylor in the Keys last week, so let's do Fort Jefferson this week. And then continue on our journey. We still need to visit the Pensacola area, which we're going to do in the near future, as well as the Seminole War forts. We've already covered in this series the forts of Northeast Florida, Fort the Castillo de San Marcos, the abandoned Fort Caroline, Fort Matanzas, Fort Mosse, Fort Clinch in Fernandina Beach, and others. So continue on our journey now to the Florida Keys, in the Florida Keys with Fort Jefferson. Part of Dry Tortugas National Park, really the big attraction of Dry Tortugas National Park. So Fort Jefferson is a former U.S. military coastal fortress, as we said, is in Dry Tortugas National Park. It is the largest brick masonry structure in the Americas, and it covers 16 acres and is made with over 16 million bricks. Among forts in the entire United States, only Fort Monroe in Virginia and Fort Adams in Rhode Island are larger. So, Ryan, you recently went to Fort Jefferson, and what were your impressions? I mean, take us through the place a little bit.
Well, it's pretty surreal. You know, you're in the Dry Tortugas National. First of all, thanks for having me, Cardiff. It's going to be on here as always. Yeah, I had the occasion to go down to the Dry Tortugas, which is, your listeners may know, it's about 70 miles west of Key West. And so, you know, you're in this mile-ish area with the different Tortugas, the different Keys, and it's just so striking and so surreal. There's literally nothing, and yet there's also this enormous, enormous man-made structure that hundreds of people and slaves and civil laborers from all over the Caribbean built. So it's really striking, first of all. It's hard to kind of picture, but that's one thing. You just approach it from this vast emptiness, and then there's all of a sudden this, like, you know, like you said, the largest masonry structure in the United States, in the Americas, rather. So it's pretty striking. It's very surreal to approach, first of all. And then as you come into it, I mean, it's really great. I think it's one of two national parks that is basically over water. So it's a really lovely location. Other people, other ships, other structures that you'll see, basically there's a big ferry that comes in and a few seaplanes, which is how most people you know, actually go to the place. Individual boats will approach it. It's quite a schlep to get out there. So you're talking about a very small. When you go out there, it's a very isolated and remote experience. So it's very striking to anybody who would go there. So that's one thing I would tell your listeners. As you also get a general impression that this purpose built place that was sort of called the key to the Gulf trade, obviously strategically located there at the very, very edge of. The very, very edge of what is now the American state of Florida, is just, you know, you're so far out, and yet you have a touch. Yeah, everything seems to be civilization in miniature because you're so far away from anything. You know, you're struck by this courtyard in the middle of the structure, which is really interesting. Probably the most sophisticated structure. We can talk about what's on the Garden Key there, where Fort Jefferson is housed, a little bit more But the most technical structure that seems to that evinces to anybody a sophisticated military is a hot shot, I think furnace it's called, which is meant to heat up cannonballs. A shot was never fired in anger there, but it's it's clearly desolate, but for articles and artifacts of war and conflict.
So the fort, and you mentioned it's one of two underwater, water national parks in the country. The other is also in southern Florida, which is Biscayne National Park, which, by the way, Disney Plus has just done a great one-hour documentary as part of their national park series on Biscayne. They actually haven't done Everglades yet, which is kind of interesting. I think there are 9 national parks in. They've done Big Bend, Yosemite, Yellowstone, some of the ones you would expect. But Biscayne, they've done pretty early in that series also. 1824 is when the site began to be built, and there was a feeling that this was a perfect location for a naval station, a perfect place to kind of guard the shipping lanes towards New Orleans in particular at the time. That was a major port that the U.S., of course, had acquired in the Louisiana Purchase of 1803. I wanted to ask you, Ryan, the first thing that actually gets built before the fort is the Garden Key Light, the lighthouse that I know you saw as well on Garden Key. Take us a little bit through just the appearance of that lighthouse, because it is pretty amazing given where it is, the location, and when you think about its strategic importance.
Yeah, it reminds one of a kettle. I'm not exactly sure. It's kind of got this blacked out, kind of dreadnought-ish, kind of very angular darkened view, which is very unique. I've never seen anything like it before, and it's set against an actual legitimate moat. There's a moat that is still active. You can actually snorkel in some of it if you've got that in your heart. And there's this kind of weird brackish area that's between the Gulf and this moat. And it's probably the densest lighthouses per area place I've ever been to, because at Loggerhead Key, I think the second largest of the keys, there's also a lighthouse. And I think that there's just one or two structures that occasional visitors, workers, and rangers will stay in. It's incredibly desolate. So there's a lighthouse right across from the lighthouse, and yes, the lighthouse at Fort Jefferson is remarkable.
So next week, we're actually going to be talking about the lighthouse at Jupiter Inlet, which was designed by someone I think everybody who follows American history knows, George Meade, later General George Meade, the hero of the Battle of Gettysburg on the Union side. Now, Fort Jefferson was originally drawn up under the supervision of then Lieutenant Montgomery Meigs, who, of course, becomes a very famous, important general Union figure in the Civil War. And Meigs' plans were actually based on a design by Joseph Totten, who Fort Totten is named for in Maryland, Washington, D.C. area. They start designing this fort, and construction didn't actually begin till 1846. I had said earlier it had begun immediately. Actually, that was the lighthouse, and that's why we dealt with the lighthouse first. So the thing that really strikes you about Fort Jefferson and the design is how there was such a kind of huge cavernous design to so much of the fort, including the Conner bastions, including the curtain walls, including even the kind of exterior of the fort. So, Ryan, tell us a little bit about that, just the striking appearance of this stuff as you're making your way around the fort.
Well, yeah, there's no other way to describe it other than surreal. It's so singular. It's the most purpose-built place, that I think might exist.
That's a great description.
Such well has been lavished on it. It is so extremely ornate and extremely, that's such a great deal of human effort and toil. I'm sure people died in the creation of it. Slaves, there was a national park literature talks about a slave escape, I think in 1847, that happened when a slave, a handful of slaves burned all of the other boats and took off and got like 50 miles away. You know, just like all of these human victories and anguish and struggle and everything that has happened the rich tapestry, the sort of menagerie of human experience that happened here, and all of the world's foremost empires is so striking when you get there. Just like it's such a desolate, it could not be an emptier sort of tableau. It's very interesting. I'll say, you know, on a personal level, it probably hard reset and cleared my mind more than anything has, you know, in many years. And certainly in my heart, as a Floridian, in the spirit of Florida, it's singular, and there's no other way. There's no way to dispute that there's just simply nothing like this place anywhere else that I've ever seen.
And the one era, Ryan, where there was actually people residing and living and working at Fort Jefferson was during the Civil War. Early in the conflict, a decision was made by the Union that they needed to secure Fort Jefferson before it fell into the hands of the Confederacy. Even prior to the Civil War, then Captain Meigs, Montgomery Meigs, took over as supervisor of the fort, 1859, 1860 time period. You know, we at this point we know secession's coming. I've actually just worked my way through The Impending Crisis, David Potter's classic book about that era, and the Union folks know secession is potentially around the corner, particularly after the Dred Scott decision and the reaction in the North to that, and Harper's Ferry, Captain John Brown, all of that. So really quickly fortified the place in 1859 and 1860, and to improve the security, they fire the heavy guns for the first time, January of 1861. And by this time, you get increasing presence of soldiers. By the time the shots are fired on Fort Sumter later that spring, you have about 168 people living at the fort. Then July and August, you have 160 more soldiers come. And then you have more and more infantry placed at Fort Jefferson by the Union, by the United States in throughout the war. And this was an important part of General Winfield Scott's Great Snake, as they called it, right? His blockade of the South, his blockade of the Confederacy, relied largely on the fortifications at Fort Jefferson and also at Fort Zachary Taylor in Key West. Those two forts were critical in kind of interrupting shipping lanes from New Orleans, which was the primary port of the Confederacy, to the outside world. So you had, by the time the Civil War ends, you have about 700, 750 Union soldiers, and you also have brought a bunch of Confederate prisoners and other prisoners, you know, deserters, Union soldiers that are being court-martialed, have been brought to Dry Tortugas, have been brought to Fort Jefferson, and obviously, in terms of labor, after the Emancipation Proclamation, those that were slaves there, that had been working as slaves, were free, and only a couple dozen black workers remained. The rest were free to go per the Union decree, or per President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. War ends, and in July of 1865, a very unique prisoner arrives, Ryan, one by the name of Dr. Samuel Mudd, and maybe you want to take us through that a little bit.
Yeah, so Dr. Samuel Mudd is very present, even on Key West, but certainly in the in the literature of the Dry Tortugas, and physically when you're there, anything that's human made at the few sort of kiosks and sort of propaganda material that they that these places provide, he's definitely omnipresent. He was a doctor, essentially, who set the leg and provided some material aid to John Wilkes Booth, of course, the assassin of Abraham Lincoln. So there was some controversy over whether he may have just been performing his Hippocratic oath and providing rendering care to somebody, or he may have been a Confederate sympathizer. He was held there on this tiny island. They gave him the real Corsica. they truly sent him as remotely into exile in America as you can.
Yeah, and obviously I think Dr. Mudd lives in some sort of infamy, although he did speaking of his Hippocratic oath, he helped provide medical care during the yellow fever epidemic at the fort in 1867 and 1868, and Mudd was pardoned after that by President Andrew Johnson, although President Johnson was giving amnesty to Confederates left and right, so he may have gone ahead and pardoned Mudd anyway. So just to finish up here, the seawall was finally completed in 1872. It wasn't done at the time of the Civil War. And more guns were installed. And eventually you had a situation where the fort became very, very critical for the Spanish-American War. But by that time, it had been consistently battered by hurricanes, and the fort had somewhat deteriorated. But after the Spanish-American War, there was an effort and at that point, actually, I should mention the fort was transferred to the Navy, so it became a naval fort starting after 1898. It was restored, but again, after another series of hurricanes, and this includes the 1906 hurricane that did so much damage to the building of the Overseas Railroad, set Henry Flagler back on that. We've talked about that previously. The fort was again abandoned. So that's basically the end of Fort Jefferson's life as a military base of sort, or military place of note. But in 1935, FDR designates it a national monument, and then, of course, in 1992, it's upgraded to full national park status. So, incredible place. And Ryan, just a couple final words on the enormity and just kind of the awe of Fort Jefferson.
Well, if we're finishing, I can't say enough. If you ever get the chance to go there, I recommend it. The place is just so, while on one hand, most Floridians won't have the ability to go there. It's so unique. It's so small. I would say that somehow it's nonetheless somehow ancestrally, spiritually, maybe the most Floridian place that I've ever been. It's like if St. Augustine were hundreds of miles away from the center of gravity here in Florida. It's a really interesting place. I found a peace and tranquility there that I just cannot recommend more highly. And it's just one of those places. World historically, there aren't that many places like it. One thing that blows my mind, Kartik, is, and I know it's not unheard of, but workers quarrying coral there for construction. I mean, it's just imagining a world in Florida here as we sit in Tallahassee and in Broward County. The people were employed by the state and by the American military, quarrying coral for construction on this place. Just absolutely, just a singular, peculiar place in Florida's history. And I cannot stress enough how visually arresting the place is. It really is. It's just something else.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Ryan. And it is an absolutely tremendous place. And I always think in my mind the two most Florida places are St. Augustine and Key West. And you've kind of convinced me, okay, you think you're in the most Florida place when you're in Key West, but get on that boat and go 70 miles. And that's even more kind of Florida, quintessential Florida.
You certainly do arrive at a certain spirit of the most quintessential Florida, for sure.
Excellent. Thank you so much.